FilmSpotting is presented by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog, now offering free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions.
For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code FILM6.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, a film spotting list that is so wacky and unbelievable, Walter Peck from the Environmental Protection Agency, 3rd District, might just show up to learn more about what it is we do here. We'll count down our top 5 movie crackpots.
I just hope he doesn't shut down the grid where we keep the ghosts of former film spotting hosts.
How dare you? How dare you, Josh? We also have a special treat for this top 5. Not only will you hear our picks, but we got film spotting favorite Mark Duplass, actor and director Mark Duplass, to share his number 1 crackpot. We're very excited to have his contribution to the top 5.
Mark is the star of 2 new films getting film spotting's focus this week, including Safety Not Guaranteed. We'll play Adam's conversation with the director of that film, Colin Trevorrow.
But first, the latest collaboration between Duplass and Hump Day director Lynn Shelton, Your Sister's Sister.
I miss you. I miss my friend.
Oh, this is that moment, isn't it?
This is your intervention. Whatever you think is helping you, I have a responsibility as your friend to tell you that it's not.
Just tell me what to do.
You know that nice red bicycle that you have?
Yes.
You're going to dust off old red, and you're going to get on a ferry. I'm sending you to my dad's place. There's no TV, there's no internet, there's nothing. It's just you.
Do they have forks?
It's just you and... We have a couple of forks, yeah.
I might need to stab myself in the face.
Sorry. I got the wrong house, and I... Hey, you're Hannah. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I'm Iris's friend, Jack.
You're on an island. It's 3 in the morning, and you're drinking by yourself. What's going on?
I just walked out on a 7-year relationship.
Whoa.
Hence the tequila.
I gotta say, not so terrible to have a drink, buddy. That's going down. Getting weird.
In Your Sister's Sister, Mark Duplass plays Jack, a guy struggling to come to terms with the death of his brother. His best friend is played by Emily Blunt, Iris, who used to date his brother. When Iris sends Jack away to her family's remote cabin for a little alone time, he's surprised to find her sister Hannah also staying there. Many tequila shots, hours of honest conversation, and a surprise visit by Iris later, and, well, things get a little complicated. Your Sister's Sister is written and directed by Lynn Shelton, and Josh, I swear I felt bad about starting off my recent interview with her by asking about working with Mark Duplass, who I've really come to appreciate the past few years as an actor and director, along with his brother Jay, of films such as The Puffy Chair, Cyrus, and Jeff Who Lives at Home. But in this case, I had a good reason. It was Duplass who set the film in motion by bringing her the original story concept. Let's hear Lynn Shelton explain that in a little bit more, and then we'll come back and discuss the film.
We'd been looking for a way to collaborate again because we'd had such a good time on Hump Day, and I think we're a good match in the creative process. And so, you know, he has this vault of movies that he and his brother Jay may turn into a movie, you know, movies someday in the future. But this one felt a little too close to home because at the center there was a guy who had recently lost his brother, and that just felt like probably something they wouldn't want to be tackling anytime soon. But he still thought it was a great kernel for a story, so he called and said, here's what I got. It's a guy and a girl. They're best friends. He's in a bad place because he's lost his brother recently. She sends him up to her family's getaway to kind of get some alone time. And there he meets her hot young mother. So I changed the mom to an older sister. And not so much because I thought that the mother wouldn't provide some interesting, you know, interesting opportunities. I'm sure that would make a great movie as well. But I really liked the idea that there were these two parallel sets of sibling relationships,
mm-hmm.
because the fourth character in the movie is the dead brother who you never meet physically, but he weighs so heavily on Jack's soul and also weighs heavily on the relationship between he and his best friend, because his best friend Iris, played by Emily Blunt, once was in a relationship with Tom, the dead brother. So there's that kind of interesting, there's like a love triangle there already. And then these two parallel relationships, complicated sister relationship, very complicated brother relationship, and it informs how he interacts with the two women. So, yeah, I just thought that would be really interesting territory. So,
yeah, you seem particularly drawn to these interpersonal dynamics and characters trying to connect in a confined space. You like to throw people together either for the first time or often they're reuniting and there's some baggage there and they're coming together. Is that just obvious? It makes for good drama when tensions kind of build up and there's kind of this claustrophobia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That tension, they're chamber pieces, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. People have pointed out to me that they'd make good plays, and they do tend to take place. I've made 3 movies in a row now with 3 characters in basically one location. And basically all over the course of a long weekend, for the most part, you know, there's a little bit of extra time at the end of Your Sister, but the bulk of the drama happens over the course of about 3 days. And that kind of confined space creates this microcosmic opportunity for the audience to really get to know these characters and to see all of them, their flaws mm-hmm. and their weaknesses, and hopefully be rooting for them in spite of that. Maybe because of that, you know, because they recognize that they're just as human as the, you know, we are ourselves.
Well, that confined space also brings out this communal aspect of filmmaking. You guys kind of go to camp when you make these films. You go into this house or wherever the setting is and basically have to live together. How much of that is just by necessity in order to make these films, limited budget, limited production schedule, and how much of it is, as you kind of said, wanting to play sociologist a little bit? I mean, you kind of get to do that as you're in the room observing how they are as people.
It's really, really wonderful. To me, it's the ideal way to make a film is to kidnap a group of collaborators and go off to some remote place, because you never stop working. I mean, you do stop working, but your off time, your off hours are feeding directly into what's going to happen the next day on set. It's really beautiful. And, you know, remarkably, somebody said, well, don't people want to get away, you know? And generally not. I mean, they can. There's places that they can go secrete themselves.
You don't have them
away,
chained to the radiator,
no.
Is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. They're all held hostage, and yet they seem to be willing victims. Yeah, there's something that happens on set that's so intimate and so wonderful that we can't wait to just, you know, have a home cooked meal together and all, you know, and everybody. I'm talking about the crew and the cast. I mean, there were a total of 16 people, including the actors. So really, it was a very tight little community. And it really is, you're right, camp is a very good, it's like film camp.
You know?
And we're working our asses off, but it's really very fun too.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with writer-director Lynn Shelton about her new film, Your Sister, and specifically her collaboration with the star of that film, Mark Duplass. And it's interesting because this is your second time in a row working with him, thinking of Hump Day, and I've been trying all morning here to come up with a clever spin on this question because I'm sure you've heard it a million times. It's probably the most common one you get, but at least your last 3 films, going back to My Effortless Brilliance, and I think that probably safe to say those are the 3 where you've been working kind of in the same similar approach, same style, and how you come at the film. You've really focused on male characters, not to undermine what happens with female characters. Certainly in this film, Your Sister, Emily Blunt's character and Rosemarie DeWitt are key figures. And certainly the wife, Alicia Delmore in Hump Day, I think that movie is just as much a husband and wife story, if not more, than it is the friendship story. That all said, Mark's character, the male characters, are kind of what drive the film forward. I'm curious if there's something in you as a woman that draws you to telling male stories.
You know, I'm going to answer the way that Mike Lee answers when people say, you keep making these wonderful movies about female characters with really real feeling female characters. And he says, I don't make movies about women. I make movies about people.
Yeah.
And it really is true for me. Those 3 films all have one thing in common, which is that I had to come at them as a sociologist, sort of from the outside in, because I didn't have direct personal experience being in a straight male friendship or being in a complicated sibling relationship either. Because I don't know if I would say that the movie, I think it's as much about Jack as it is about the sisters, but I really feel like that's a huge, for me, the sister relationship is a very, very key one. But my relationships with my siblings are incredibly uncomplicated and boring and just sort of pure love. And so they're unfettered by a lot of baggage or layers of jealousies or competition, at least on my end. You'd have to ask my siblings how they feel about me. But on my part, I didn't feel like I could draw on personal experience as much. But I've observed around me, I do have to say, I'm a pretty good people watcher and have always been compelled and fascinated by the human condition and by the dynamics of interpersonal relationships. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed these incredibly layered, convoluted, complicated, deep, you know, textured relationships between siblings where there's this incredible bond and this desire and deep need to connect, but it's complicated by all kinds of, you know, just resentments and jealousies and sort of held, you know, resentments that are held onto long after betrayals, mm-hmm. have, you know, from the past have happened. And you know, it's this, I keep coming back again and again to relationships. I'm really moved by when people try to connect with each other and they can't because of whatever obstructions. And that straight male friendship is a nice territory for that. I think, you know, it's a little bit more complicated for straight guys to tell each other, you know, the basic I love you, man, kind of thing. The I love you has to be qualified by the man.
Right.
Anyway, and
the bro hug.
The bro hug. Yeah, exactly. And it's always a little awkward. And, you know, and for certain siblings, I think it's the same kind of thing. So I'm always drawn to that kind of territory, you know.
That was writer-director Lynn Shelton talking about her new film, Your Sister, Sister. If you want to hear our full conversation, it's available via our podcast feed, which you can get through iTunes, or you can listen at filmspotting.net. We talk in more detail about her improvisational style of filmmaking and how directing an episode of Mad Men last season actually inspired her to try something different with her next project. It's a film coming out next year called Touchy Feely, starring Ellen Page. Josh, how did her approach here work for you?
It did work. It felt very improvisational. That's a clear influence in the style of working for her. What I also thought was interesting about the interview is she seems so kind and generous, and I get this sense that she's almost diabolical in these predicaments she puts her characters in.
Right.
And she watches them squirm, we squirm in the audience, and you'd almost resent her for that, except with Hump Day and now Your Sister's Sister, she's still able to mine these deep emotional reservoirs and come out with observations about human relationships that we might not have otherwise gotten to without all that discomfort. So I do appreciate that, but it was just kind of this imbalance from hearing her in the interview and how she talks about the process.
Yeah, that's really funny. And actually, it reminds me of my recent conversation with Mark Duplass. Of course, as I said at the front of the show, we're going to hear him during our top five. And also in that same podcast with Lynn Shelton, you can hear my full interview with him. And he talks about working with her. And one of the joys of working with Lynn Shelton is that he says she enjoys watching actors and working with actors in a way he's never seen any other director before. Just the pure expression of joy and happiness on her face as she watches people act in her films is something he's never seen. So clearly there's just this spirit of fun. Despite sometimes the heady subject matter, she is having a really good time watching these characters dive into this dark material.
Well, and you probably have to have that approach and that camaraderie and that joy if you are going to put people in these uncomfortable situations. You know, they'll go there for you. So, I did like Your Sister's Sister. I mean, it's a very small film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think those things that she finds in terms of personal relationships and human relationships echo quite as far out as they did in Hump Day. I don't know if it's just the isolated setting here
with
this cabin on the island, but this feels very constrained to these three people and their particular problems. And it didn't kind of reverberate for me like Hump Day did in terms of how we all see our own relationships with friends or in marriages or whatever it might be. But that being said, you know, Your Sister's Sister does have this interesting exploration of searching for a family.
Yeah,
is what I found was interesting about it, no matter how unconventional that family might be. But the three characters here, each of them and their allusions to how their families have been torn apart in different ways, and they're all kind of searching and fumbling to recreate a family in spite of that, or maybe because of that. And so that was kind of an interesting undercurrent for me that I did appreciate the film, even if it didn't seem quite as big in terms of theme or impact as something like Hump Day.
Sorry, what? Three to go?
The 10-year itch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was with her mom for 10 years. Had an affair with my mom, who was the secretary.
Got your mom, Lenora,
yes.
Pregnant. Married her.
Moved to London. Got bored of Lenora. And then he moved on. And then he kind of philandered around for like 7 years.
He went through his crazy Warren Beatty phase. The funny thing, though, about those years when he was so bad with the ladies, he was so good with us because that was...
He wasn't.
No, but that was like 6 summers. That was just the three of us here.
I know, but you were okay with that. I had no respect for that. He just went... He dodged from one to the other, and it was gross.
That's so crazy. So he would just, like, date all these women, like, for short periods of time with not a lot of emotional investment.
Yeah, it was
horrible. And they were very similar, and then he would just move on?
Yeah.
God, that's just weird. Who does that? Oh! And the patterns emerge!
What are you doing?
You're listening to Film Spotting, Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson talking about the new small but rewarding film, Your Sister's Sister, out this weekend. It's written and directed by Lynn Shelton. And I can see what you're saying in terms of the far-reaching reverberations. It's true that I don't think it's as universal as Hump Day, a movie I really adore, but there's a simplicity to this story. It's certainly not full of surprises. There's one little twist that, I'll be honest, I didn't see coming at all that I think is interesting, but I do think there's some resonance here in the story of a brother not dealing so much with his brother's death, but the guilt of the relationship he had with his brother when his brother passed away. He's really trying to come to terms with his brother, who he was as a person, and their relationship, and how he probably didn't fully appreciate him while he was alive. And so there's some symmetry that comes into play here, of course, as he becomes wedged in the middle of these two sisters and possibly keeping them apart, and his desire not to replicate something like what clearly happened with he and his brother with these two sisters. And I think that whether you've been in a situation exactly like that before, you have siblings similar to this or similar relationships with your siblings, we can all probably relate to the passing of someone and that feeling of guilt or that feeling of, did I do enough? Was I good enough to them? Did I give them enough of a chance? That's something that seems to me pretty universal.
And it does open with Duplass's character and kind of focuses on those issues he has you're talking about. But this really evolves to become a very equal, three-part equal understanding of where each of these people are coming from, the problems they're struggling with, and how they can both complicate things for each other and then perhaps help solve some of the problems. Yeah. The acting's really good.
It's so good.
Across the board.
Rosemary DeWitt, Emily Blunt, they're all great.
Yeah, they are. And Duplass has also a really good scene. There are a few scenes outside of this cabin or without at least two of them together. But in light of our top five bicycle scenes,
yeah.
Did you enjoy the one where he just, moment of frustration, goes at his bike and finds about seven different ways to damage a bike? It's too bad we didn't see this in time for top five.
It's definitely one we need to throw on the honorable mention list anyway. But I talked about this with Shelton in our interview. Her movies just really work for me. Again, you use that word small, and they are. And maybe I just like small, kind of talky, interpersonal, dynamic films like this where you throw people together, they're connecting for the first time or they're reconnecting for the first time in a long time, and you put them in a confined space and you wait for the baggage to come out and for people to drop the facade of politeness and that painful honesty comes out. It just works for me. It worked in one of her previous films, My Effortless Brilliance. Hump Day is a little bigger in that all the scenes don't take place in a confined space. But at the same time, it is about an old friend coming back and living at their house and everything that comes out of that relationship. So that's something that just works for me. And it was interesting to see here, though, how unlike those two films, Lynn Shelton was up to something different with the camera. Those movies very much followed that mumblecore style that her films get lumped in with, rightly or wrongly, where oftentimes it's handheld camera and it's a little bit shaky and it's a lot of close-ups. Just trying to give you the sense that the camera's in the room, you're kind of a fly on the wall with these people. With this movie, she holds back on the claustrophobia a little bit. It's more traditional in terms of some two shots and some wider shots and not relying on that shakiness a little bit. So it's interesting just to watch her try to do something different, but at the same time, still get those great immediate moments, those great improvisational moments that only working in this way can give you.
There are even some landscape panoramas at the beginning.
There are, yeah.
And you wonder, is this, there's so many of them as Mark Duplass's character is traveling to this island by bike. You wonder if it's going overboard a little bit, is proving, you know, we can be outside of a room. Right. I mean, they're lovely. They're beautiful. I think this is taking place on an island outside of Seattle. They're beautiful to look at, but you're right. It's such a contrast to her earlier style.
Your Sister's Sister is out in select cities this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and over on Facebook, facebook.com/FilmSpotting. And again, if you do want to hear my full conversation with Lynn Shelton, you'll be able to get it through iTunes via the Film Spotting regular show feed, but we'll also put a link to it on the interviews page of FilmSpotting.net.
Up next, Adam's interview with Safety Not Guaranteed director Colin Trevorrow. I hope he brought his own weapons. And our thoughts on the film starring Aubrey Plaza and some guy named Mark Duplass. Stay with us.
Stand straight, fall back in line, comb your hair, get to work on time. Everyone in the big machine tries to break your heart and pull you underneath. Maybe I'm wrong and all that you get is what you see. Maybe I'm right and there's something out there to believe. Everybody's talking in their sleep. They push a lot of air around but don't say much of anything. Except when they're laughing like some ghosts under a sheet. Everybody's talking in their sleep. Watch out, get back in line.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog.
Squarespace has been a great sponsor of Film Spotting over the past few months on the show, and one of the things I love about Squarespace is that many of our listeners, Josh, use Squarespace to produce their website or blog, and we actually have a couple of recommendations from actual Film Spotting listeners. Laura in Jersey City, New Jersey says she used it for a while and recommends Squarespace for painless, professional hosting with excellent support, and Laura emphasizes excellent. So clearly she was a fan of the product. And Nate and Kate Tate writes in, "Hey Adam and Josh, we use it for our site, feedingthedragon.com, devouring all things China and Chinese food. It's great because you can fully customize it without being a web code whiz." So again, actual recommendations there. I checked out feedingthedragon.com, a really nice looking site, not square, boxy, not what you expect sometimes when you get these templated services, but it looks really great, really professional, and Squarespace has recently reduced their prices. They've got great incentives during the month of June, making it one of the best times ever to sign up for a new account. You heard some of the features there from Laura and Nate and Kate, but they've got hundreds of design templates to choose from. They've got iPhone, iPad, and Android apps, so you can update your blog on the go, and they do have online resources and special support to give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They've also simplified their subscription plans and provided reduced pricing. Their standard plan starts as low as $8 a month.
For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. You can sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out. Start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM6 and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. Don't forget about free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. That's squarespace.com and use offer code FILM6.
They'll trip you up. It happens every time. Way down. It's just a big machine. It can break apart like anything. Maybe I'm wrong.
May I ask you something?
Please do.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers. What would you be willing to do?
Anything and everything.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that's a scene from Ridley Scott's Prometheus, just opened last weekend. The very divisive, much debated Prometheus, and we're going to try to get your thoughts. We want to get your verdict on the film as we get to the Film Spotting poll a bit later in this segment. But right now, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a prize. Last week on our live 400th show, we massacred this scene.
You know, I don't have that record. I'll buy it for 40. We're out.
So, now why would you sell it to me and not to him?
Because you're not a geek, Lewis.
You guys are snobs.
No, we're not.
No, seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars, so you're shit on the people who know less than you.
No.
Which is everybody.
Yeah.
It's just sad.
That's all. That's John Cusack, Jack Black, and I hope I'm saying this right, Alex Desaye from 2000's High Fidelity. Todd Luizzo is actually in that scene as well. We had to do a little bit of trickery with the dialogue to pare it down from four people to three, as we did bring a guest actor from the audience.
Very talented.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Anon here in a moment. But that film, High Fidelity, directed, of course, by Stephen Frears, written by D.V. DeVincentis, Steve Pink, John Cusack, and Scott Rosenberg.
Roger McDormand wrote in. He explained the tie-in really well. He says, "High Fidelity, a film about a group of hardcore pop culture junkies in Chicago who process all that's good and meaningful in life through a series of top five lists. What that has to do with this episode, or film spotting in general, I can't begin to imagine.
Well done, Roger. You, of course, did nail why we chose that scene. It seems so appropriate, too, because we're doing our live 400th show at Lincoln Hall, which happens to be right across the street from the Biograph Theater where John Dillinger was gunned down. And there's a great scene in High Fidelity where John Cusack comments on that, on how Dillinger just wanted to go out and see a movie and his girlfriend sold him out and betrayed him. Fits into the larger scope of that film.
And as obvious as this choice was, I think it came to you like the day of, right?
It did,
we had something else planned.
We have done it before, but it was 3 or 4 years ago. And when you're doing the 400th show,
oh, it was perfect.
It seems like it's such a film spotting movie, very clearly because of the top five tie-in. But I do want to say this because everyone said, well, like Roger, you got your inspiration for the top five list you do on the show from High Fidelity. That's true. But it wasn't actually the movie High Fidelity. It was the book High Fidelity.
Okay.
I read the book back in 1999, I think just the year before the movie came out. And my first show, the first incarnation of film spotting, was my radio show as a grad student at the University of Iowa. It was called Burn Hollywood Burn. We did Massacre Theater. We started that there. And also the top five concept came from me reading that book and just loving it. I was obsessed with that book, High Fidelity. So it actually goes back to Nick Hornby's story. The funny part, too, is our listeners did search for other meanings, other connections, as they are wont to do. And some found a couple tie-ins with Prometheus.
Oh, of course. Ben Shepherd was one of those from London. He wrote, the connection obviously being that surprising third act twist in Prometheus, in which all the characters listed their top five big existential themes without ever expanding on them.
I missed that one.
Ben
I miss
is
that scene.
Speaking my language.
I missed that scene, Ben. I don't know what you're talking
That's
about.
That's a perfect review of Prometheus right there.
We also got this from Finn in Norway. The tie-in probably has something to do with the Chicago location of your live show, etc. I don't know. What I know is High Fidelity and Prometheus are both American films directed by Englishmen with Scandinavian lead actresses.
How about that?
That is true. Certainly did not plan on that connection, but thank you, Finn and Ben and Roger and everyone else who donated. We do have to talk just for a second about our volunteer from the audience, Anon, who came up. And, you know, I think about Mr. Mom, one of my favorite movies from the 80s. You remember that scene where Michael Keaton, he's all pumped up to race against Martin Ball, to race against the boss in that big party that's going on, and he's limbering up, and then everyone tells him, what are you doing? You can't win. He's the boss. Your wife's going to get in trouble if you win. You got to make him look good.
Right.
And he throws the race. Anon, your job was to come up on stage and make us look good, not outshine us.
There was a reason he stood up so quickly when we asked for a volunteer. He was actually talented.
Yes, he was, and very clearly a drama major or someone who probably studied at Second City. And you made us look bad, but it was great. It was a lot of fun.
It was
Thank
fun.
You for being a good sport. Why don't you reach into that brimming film spotting hat, Josh?
Which everyone knows now is fake.
Oh, can't we go back to the myth now, the illusion?
No,
of it?
We can't. We might have to change it up
or start
bringing in hats.
Why don't you read the name off the sheet of paper in front of you of this week's winner?
That winner would be Ashley Ann Kriegbaum from Oakland, California.
Congratulations, Ashley Ann. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
Time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
And this week's Massacre Theater winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. Josh, we actually flipped a coin to decide who is going to get to do the heavy lifting here in this scene. I don't know if you won or lost, but
we'll find out.
It.
We'll find out soon.
Indeed. And you're not going to need any help with this one. It ties in with our top five theme this week, movie crackpots. I think this one definitely qualifies. And yeah, this is probably a little bit too on the nose, but
When the scenes are this good.
It's a fun scene.
Yeah, you've got to just take it.
All right, you're going to start it off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Don't worry about it. It won't be permanent. You want to see something permanent? Ba-ba-boom. Hey, you want to feel something permanent? Just put your head underneath my cap. You just feel that lump? Nakanolum. Zambadida. Boston.
I got that beat. I got that beat. It's a moray eel bit right through my wetsuit.
Well, now listen. I don't know about that, but I entered an arm wrestling contest in an Okie bar in San Francisco. You see this? Now I can't extend that. You know why? Got to the semifinal. Celebrating my third wife's demise. Big Chinese fella. He pulled me right over. Ha!
And scene. I have no idea what you were doing, Josh.
Could you understand any of those words?
Barely. All right. Barely. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net, you landlubbers. The deadline is Tuesday, June 19th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Doc, don't say a word. I don't want to know your name. I don't want to know anything about you.
Listen,
Doc.
Don't tell me anything.
Doc, quiet. Quiet. I'm going to read your thoughts.
Let's see now.
You come here from a great distance?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't tell me. You want me to buy a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post?
No.
Not a word. Not a word. Not a word now. Quiet. Donations. You want me to make a donation to the Coast Guard Youth Auxiliary.
Doc, I'm from the future.
Well, speaking of our top five this week, movie crackpots, last week on our 400th show, we anticipated this top five with our poll question. We wanted to know which one of these movie crackpots or this group of movie crackpots would you rather hang out with? Would you rather, Josh, bus ghosts with Peter Venkman and crew, of course, from the great Ivan Reitman film Ghostbusters, or ride shotgun in Doc Brown's DeLorean, a reference to the great Robert Zemeckis film from the 80s, Back to the Future. When we did this live with the crowd, and we did it just by applause, it was about 80-20 Back to the Future.
Yeah, that sounds
about right.
Everyone
was definitely into time travel, which I don't blame them, but I did try to throw out there that time travel versus hanging with Bill Murray, that's a little bit of a decision. You do have to at least think about it for a second, but what did Film Spotting listeners online say?
Less of them want to be Ghostbusters, actually, only 39%, whereas Doc Brown's DeLorean won with 61%.
There you go, 61%. Maybe not a surprise. That was a clear pick for you.
No, I don't want to get in the DeLorean.
Okay.
Time travel, dangerous. It doesn't work in the movies.
And ghosts aren't dangerous?
Not in Ghostbusters.
That's true. Well, thank you to everyone who voted in that poll question. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and vote in this week's poll. And it gets back to our discussion last week of Ridley Scott's new film, Prometheus. As we said, very divisive, a lot of gnashing of teeth about this film. On Twitter, especially, if you follow various movie folks, and we're very split on this film as well.
We'll be gnashing teeth a little later.
You did not enjoy it nearly as much as I did, so we simply want to know from you, Prometheus is
an abomination, a flawed but worthy entry in alien mythology, a masterpiece, don't care, won't see it.
So, Josh, I know where you're going. I saw your review on your website. 1.5 stars, you're going an abomination.
Abomination,
basically.
I mean, that's strong for 1.5 stars, but yeah, I'm clearly in that crowd.
I would love to call it a masterpiece. I don't think it's a masterpiece.
Oh, my goodness.
I think
you're
it's
even considering?
Flawed. Yeah, I am.
Wow.
Only because I had that much fun with it. I really did. I had a really good, intense time watching Prometheus. That said, I'm not really considering it as a masterpiece. It is, for me, a flawed but worthy entry into the alien mythology. I definitely think it fits in with Alien and Aliens, and I enjoyed the film. So, yes, that is my vote. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. And if you want more Prometheus talk, we're guessing most people listening to this did go see it, though it didn't have an amazing weekend at the box office, as I recall.
It lost to Madagascar 3, right?
There you go.
I don't know what that says, actually.
I don't either. Not a family movie, clearly.
You know what? I do have a theory now that I think about it. I think geek culture is louder than the number of people it actually represents.
There's
so
no
doubt. We just think that, you know, it's going to be this
everyone must
huge,
have seen
right,
what he's talking
right,
about.
Right, and really, it's just a very vocal minority.
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something there. But we're going to talk about Prometheus more in our bonus content. It will probably go into spoiler territory, but we'll dive into it a little bit more. You can get that bonus content by going to filmspotting.net. There's a link there for apps, or download the Film Spotting app and get it right there on your smartphone. You can get those by visiting the App Store on Amazon or iTunes, of course, to get your iPhone or iPad app as well. And I should put out another plug to the Slate spoiler special. I had a chance to sit down with Dana Stevens, who is a guest of our 400th show, but she was there to talk about Moonrise Kingdom. We sat down the next day and recorded a 40-minute discussion of Prometheus that clearly crossed into spoiler territory. That's the entire point of the show. And I did have a chance there, Josh, to get into some of the things I really did love about the film and some of the things I really didn't like at all about the movie, while also really just trying to wrestle with some of those ambiguities and those questions that
you got to talk about. So much doesn't make sense that you've got to talk it out and try to piece it together.
Are they provocative ambiguities, or is it just bad writing? That question I posed to you guys on the 400 show, we tried to get into a little bit of that in that Slate Spoiler Special. If you want to hear that, I encourage you to check it out. Do a search in iTunes for Slate Spoiler Special, or there's a link right in the top stories over at filmspotting.net. I think we do need to spend a moment, Josh, real quick here, and just say thank you to everyone who came out to the 400th show.
Great crowd.
All in all, a great crowd, a great success. The night went a little longer than we anticipated it would.
I could have told you that it would go longer.
We knew that would happen. And of course, we thanked everyone during the show, but it was great with Tyler from WBEZ, our producer, Golden Joe Dassault. They were so integral in making that night happen. Really could not have happened without them. And it only occurred to me later, Josh, that the listening audience, if you weren't there, you probably weren't aware that former Film Spotting co-host turned Film Spotting producer Sam Van Hallgren was actually there.
Right.
He was our MC, so he got to take the mic and warm the crowd up a little bit.
He did a great warm-up. Eased us into it. It was awesome.
From Chicago, and it was definitely nice to have Sam come all the way from North Carolina up to Chicago for our 400th episode. Again, we just want to say thanks, and we had a lot of fun. I haven't actually listened to the whole 400th episode yet. There's a part of me, Josh, that doesn't want to because I just want it to continue.
It was such a good time.
I want it to continue on in my head as being a perfect show.
Yeah, I could see that.
And so I'm just going to choose to believe that.
You know what? I have listened to it, and it's just so fun to hear the crowd again interacting and hear them in the background.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. It was so great that people did come out.
Of course, thanks to Lincoln Hall. And we do hope to make this a semi-regular occurrence. We had enough fun that we think maybe at least once or twice a year it's something we can do, have live episodes. So look forward to more information about that. Another plug in iTunes for those who are heavy podcast subscribers, Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. This is the offshoot of Film Spotting where Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore talk about movies that are available via streaming, whether it's Fandor.com or it's Hulu or Netflix, whatever the outlet might be. It's a great show. They've been doing it every 2 weeks. We're really excited that it looks like in July that's going to start being a weekly show. And up to now, listeners have been getting it just by subscribing to Film Spotting. You can get it as part of our regular feed. But we've actually set up a separate page in iTunes. And moving forward, if you want to subscribe just to Streaming Video Unit, you can get that through that separate link. And you can get that just by doing a search in iTunes or going to filmspottingsvu.com and clicking on the iTunes button there. And I think the show has been fantastic so far. We hope every Film Spotting listener will subscribe to get future shows from Matt and Allison. And my final bit of promotion, Josh, now that the 400th show is over, I don't get
to rest
at all.
You're going to relax. You're going to take it easy.
I wish. But next week, June 20th, is actually my first class at the University of Chicago. Open to everyone, part of the Graham School for Continuing Education. It's an 8-week course. We're focusing on documentaries, specifically cinema verite. And I'm really excited about it. I hope listeners are as well, and that we'll get a few more of them to sign up. But the class is definitely happening. Good registration so far. This is your last week to do it, though. It starts next Wednesday, June 20th. So if you're in the Chicago area and sitting in an air-conditioned room on a Wednesday night for 8 weeks with me sounds like fun. I mean, who would want to miss that?
Let me ask you this.
You can do it.
My kids have been out of school for a week and a half, and they're already getting squirrely with not enough things to do. Can I send them there?
I bet they'd have as much to contribute as me.
Okay.
So I'll sign them up. Please do. Also, if you want information about that, filmspotting.net is the place to find it, right there in the top stories.
Writers, does anybody have an idea for a story?
How about this time travel ad? Guy writes a classified that reads, "Wanted, someone to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after we get back. Must bring your own weapons. Safety not guaranteed. I've only done this once before. I want to find this guy.
You know, see if maybe he believes in this stuff. I don't know. I think it could be funny.
You want to do it?
Can I get a couple of interns? Help me with
the
research?
Me. Do. Please. Me.
All right, give me the lesbian and the Indian, and I got a story. What'd you get?
Guy's name, where he works. What makes you think he won't slam the door in my face, too?
Probably none of the other people were beautiful girls.
Easier now.
Do you sell guns here? Something sexy and affordable with killing power?
Is there a pest problem?
Well, if your ad had been written properly, I may have a better idea of what I need. I hope you worked harder on your calibrations.
My calibrations are flipping pinpoint, okay? Mm. You ever face certain death?
If it was so certain, I wouldn't be here, would I?
An actual classified ad inspired both the title and concept for Safety Not Guaranteed, which we just heard. This is a Sundance film from writer Derek Connolly and director Colin Trevorrow. The ad was looking for a partner on a time-traveling mission, and among the qualifiers was that you must bring your own weapons and that safety was not guaranteed. For the movie, indie multi-hyphenate Mark Duplass plays Kenneth, the author of the ad, while Aubrey Plaza of television's Parks and Recreation plays a magazine intern who goes undercover to find out if Kenneth is for real.
Well, instead of preparing for our 400th show like I should have been, Josh, I was busy doing interviews with directors such as Colin Trevorrow, and I started by asking him about that amazing magazine ad. Did anyone over the years try to track down the guy who wrote it?
Yeah, we tracked down the author of that ad, and it was a requisite for getting the film made. We had to go to the mountains of Oregon and find this guy, and actually it is a mission that had been attempted by many people before. People had staked out the P.O. box, and they thought they'd found his house, and there were all kinds of websites that popped up, you know, tracking this guy down. And
so it's similar to the movie in that regard.
Very similar to the movie. And ultimately, I did find the author. His name is John Silvera. He lives in Gold Beach, Oregon, where they published Backwoods Home, which is the magazine it was originally published in. And John and I forged a relationship over the course of about a year where I convinced him to trust me that I wasn't going to destroy his legacy, which is this beautiful six-sentence haiku, as I like to think of it. It's a story in a classified ad, and I think he likes what we did. I hope he likes what we did.
If I have the timeline right, your partner Derek Connolly had already written a draft of this script before that had even happened, before you had met him. What was it like then when the reality faces the fantasy you guys had created?
Well, you know, from a logistical standpoint, it was a new challenge because I realized if we were going to make this film, we actually were going to want to find the guy who wrote it. And both, you know, whether or not that was legally necessary, I felt that because it was a bit of a story, Derek and I as writers felt that it was just the right thing to do. And yet we never held John responsible for living up to the fantastic character that classified ad promises. And yet he does in a lot of ways. He does bring his own weapons. So he did sort of fulfill some of our wildest dreams in his own way.
But then did you feel any obligation to alter anything to make it match him?
No, because, you know, ultimately it is a piece of fiction and John doesn't sincerely believe that he can go back in time. And we felt that what we wanted to do is create a new character that was iconic in his own way and not necessarily by just having a mullet and a shotgun and believing he can go back in time, but having real regrets and needing a time machine to fix some mistakes that he's made in his life. And I think that, you know, for me, time travel is most effective when it both in films and in everyone's own personal fantasy, when you can go back and repair some of the damage you've done to your own life. And this character has a real need to fix his mistakes, and it's what made him compelling. And I think that adding on, you know, the hilarity of a guy with a mullet and a shotgun and an old yellow Datsun who has some real emotional needs attracted us.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with director Colin Trevorrow. His new film is Safety Not Guaranteed. You mentioned time travel and how it's used a little bit in other films and other works of art. Definitely not accurate to call this a time travel movie, and yet it is a major part of the plot, clearly. Did you look to any other time travel movies for inspiration, or were those ever a big influence on you?
Yeah, well, we really wanted it to be its own thing, and a time travel film that I found to be similar in what it attempts is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is about emotional time travel. Mm-hmm. And yet also all of the time travel films that I have really attached to over the course of my, you know, 20 years of fandom of that genre, they often have characters that are needing to travel in time to deal with something personal. Even Back to the Future is about a guy making sure that his parents fall in love, which is a very personal movie goal. And this has several characters who have different reasons why they need a time machine. And I felt like if we could find something that was grounded in an emotion that is pretty universal, I think we all have regrets, we could make something that would support some of the more fantastical things we were hoping to do with the movie.
Aubrey Plaza is the star of the film, is our conduit to meeting Kenneth, the character who did produce that ad. And if I understand it right, Derek Connolly, the screenwriter, had her in mind all along for this role. Did you guys have a backup plan if that didn't work out?
No, we never have backup plans with a movie like this. So this was a small independent film, and one of the benefits of that is we were able to cast who we felt was absolutely right. And, you know, Mark Duplass was not a movie star at the time, and even to this day, I think he has existed in films as characters that are somewhat similar to who he is as a person, and that's what makes his form of improvisation, I think, work so well in his films and as a director. And in this film, you know, Mark played a character, and it was something that was very exciting for us to have someone that was not familiar to audiences be, you know, this mysterious time traveler, and also, you know, with Aubrey, to have someone who sort of represents an archetype, a kind of young woman that I think she's representative of a lot of young women today who feel, you know, they're out of college and they don't feel like there's anything there for them. And maybe their parents told them that if they follow all of their wildest dreams, they can accomplish those dreams just by believing and trying real hard, and then getting a slap of reality in the face and being a little angry about that, of like, wow, and no one really cares about me and I'm an intern and being treated terribly. And I think that, you know, she is someone who really still wants to believe in something, and, you know, being able to take her on that course, you know, using the preconceived notions of who Aubrey Plaza is that people have from other characters that she's played. Mm-hmm. We were able to play off of that in the movie, which was great.
You do play off of it, and you get her to go a little bit deeper, maybe a little bit darker, more dramatic than she has in previous roles. She said that was a little bit more difficult for her as a challenge for an actress, as a director. How do you work with her through those tougher moments?
You know, she came very prepared, and I think in addition to that, her moments with Mark Duplass, in which there was a lot of improvisation. We don't have a lot of improvised comedy in our film, but we have a lot of improvised drama. And because that's how Mark works as a director, he was able to, in the course of a scene and you know, while they're on film, he and Aubrey were able to find new things together that weren't in the script, and some wonderful moments that some of my favorite in the film that came from the two of them just existing within the skins of those two characters and just being honest.
Well, I want to focus on Mark Duplass for a second because, and this won't be a surprise to longtime Film Spotting listeners, they know how big of a fan I am of his work. I'm a fan of the films he's made with his brother Jay, but also his work in a movie like Hump Day. I think I'm a bigger fan of that film than Lynn Shelton might be, actually. I've said so many positive things about it. But here's a guy who's now appeared in several films and has made several films himself. You're a first-time feature filmmaker. How much do you tap into him as a resource and draw from what you can learn and go to him when you need advice?
You know, what was great about Mark is that he was able to bring a performance to the table that was so nuanced and so thought out, as if he had sat and directed himself once already. And so by the time, you know, we got on set, we were able to have conversations about what was most true to the character at any given moment, but he didn't know that character, and he was living in that character, and that was something that all of the actors did, and I think did very well. And because we had to move so quickly, what I said to everyone before they came is, you know, do your preparation, but that preparation is you are this person, and you are that person for the 4 weeks that we're there, and so that we're going to be able in our tight schedule to have the room to let you breathe and let you breathe life into these characters and bring something new. And I think with all four of the actors, there's so much that they brought to the table just by spending the time to become those people. And you know, one thing that we do over the course of the movie, which I'm sure you observed, is we start with almost archetypes of characters, and then we slowly not deconstruct them, but we turn them into real people. Mm-hmm. We start with the Indian nerd, and then we turn him into a real human being. And likewise with the kooky, quirky time travel, and he's a real human being. And we all knew that was a goal, and we did it with the filmmaking as well. We did it with the costumes, with the music. Everything was about having the movie slowly bring you in and ease you to a place that you'll buy whatever we choose to do.
I want to go back to something you said I thought was really fascinating in talking about Mark. You mentioned improvised drama, and surely you think of improvisation in films. You do attach it to movies that the Duplass brothers make, but you do think of it primarily as a comedic trope, something to elicit laughs. And in this case, as you said, it was something that really you found helped with drama. Can you give us a moment from the film without spoiling anything that was one of those kind of improvised magic moments?
Yeah, I can give you two. One was between Aubrey and Mark's characters. There's a moment where he asks her what her favorite song is, and she mm-hmm. says it's Over the Rainbow, and he has this beautiful little soliloquy about, you know, how a song that you've heard it represents a time and a place in your life, and you can't go back to that place, and it's just so thematically on point and yet completely concocted between the two of them in that moment without any prior discussion. And it was very wow. real. That is her favorite song. I mean, that was a real moment. And likewise with Jake Johnson and Karin Soni's characters, there's a scene later in the film where Jake's character is sort of schooling Arnau on how to get his first kiss and how to get in there and be confident. And he pops his collar up, puts sunglasses on him. And, you know, the setup was there, but exactly how that went about was a moment between the two of them. And Jake brought all of that to the table. Wow. And even though that's very funny, it's also very poignant. There's a lot of layers going on there. And that's the kind of stuff for me. I feel, you know, Derek Connolly is a hilarious writer and I trust in his comedy very much. And it was all very distinctive. And so I wanted to keep the comedy tone very consistent while allowing the actors to focus all of their improvisational instincts on finding more honest moments between them.
Why are you sitting here? Why would you be sitting on your computer? You're a young man. You got the whole world ahead of you. I'm asking you to be a man and try. Are you ready to have a crazy night with me? Because I'm ready.
No.
Say you're ready. No. Say you're ready.
I'm ready.
My man, good answer. Come on. Let's do something stupid.
Safety Not Guaranteed, a movie that has many wonderful moments. We're talking with the director, Colin Trevorrow, and you've mentioned some of the great cast members in this movie. And Jake Johnson, for me, in a supporting role here, is the main writer who takes Aubrey Plaza's character and Karin, his character, Arnau, to be his interns on this project. He starts out a certain way, and you're right. You learn so much more about him as you go, but there are also moments you give him certain elements right at the beginning where we don't completely write him off as a total jerk. And he's a guy who we actually do enjoy spending time with somehow, even as he's also very annoying. But as an actor, he's someone who I remember briefly in Get Him to the Greek and 21 Jump Street, small roles there. I know some people know him from The New Girl, that show with Zooey Deschanel, but otherwise a fairly new face for me. And he stole every scene he was in this movie. He's really wonderful. You know him going back to your NYU days, I believe. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about that relationship a little bit and what makes his performance so good from your perspective?
Well, yeah, Jake and I have been friends for about 10 years. We did go to NYU together, but we didn't know each other there. We met in Los Angeles through a mutual friend, and both of us peripherally as friends were following our own paths. And miraculously, we both reached a point at the same time where it would be possible for us to work together. And one thing that made that so easy is that, you know, I know how to talk to Jake. Jake and I have a relationship. So our language together was already established when we got on set, whereas I really needed to learn Aubrey a bit as a person. I needed to learn Mark as a person. And I think with Jake, because he has an ability to deliver six different takes that are slightly different and yet elicit a completely different emotional response from the viewer, he provides a director with so many options and so many ways to let you into a scene and into a moment that are all funny in different ways, which is remarkable.
I want to ask you about one moment in particular with his character, probably his biggest moment in the film, though it's a very small one. And that's a moment without spoiling anything, hopefully, here. He has an encounter with someone he used to know where he has to open himself up in a way that he really probably has never done before. The sense I got watching it was he's never been this vulnerable and open in his life. And physically, it's almost like he gags on his own vulnerability. It's such a great, subtle moment. And I was just curious if you could talk about that moment and how that scene really was crafted.
Well, that scene, yeah, without ruining anything, we really wanted to get him to a point where he poured his heart out, and in a way that characters often have in films and are then rewarded, and we wanted to reject him and see how he responded to that. And to me, that was where the thematic connection between our more literal time travel storyline and our more metaphorical time travel mm-hmm. storyline meet. That scene could also be in a movie called Safety Not Guaranteed. And it's where hopefully everything comes together and you realize why this guy is in the movie in the first place and why that story is relevant in a time travel film. And, you know, that scene between the two of them, we actually, because we were moving so quickly, we shot that entire relationship, every scene between the two of them in one day.
Wow.
In the same house. And he had to go through, it's an amazing feat of acting, and that he had to go through this huge arc over the course of 12 hours. And he said it was the hardest day of acting that he'd ever endured. And yet you really feel him on his toes. And both of them, and Jenica Bergere does a wonderful job.
Mm-hmm.
You really feel them, not overworking, because I think it all feels very, very natural and effortless in a certain way. But I was never more impressed with him than I was on that day when he was able to take us through that whole journey.
And you've talked about some of the themes of the film overall as we've had this conversation. But for me, that moment, I think why I liked it so much, and that entire storyline, as you touched on, it really ties back into the main A story there so well. And it seemed to me that on some major level, this whole film is about characters ultimately opening themselves up to other people, into the world, and allowing themselves to be vulnerable. They all have kind of preconceived notions about themselves and how the world works, and they go through a transformation as the film goes on. I mean, it sounds obvious, the nature of drama, to have these characters go through some kind of change, but that vulnerability in that sense that the way they thought the world worked is exactly how it doesn't work, mm-hmm. is kind of at the core of this film.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and again, I think it's why Derek felt that title works so well for a movie that isn't solely about, you know, literal time travel.
Right.
And it's something that I take great pride in it, because I know how much everyone brought to it. This movie isn't solely my vision. Like, this movie really is the result of a set of instincts I possess that I think very clearly come from, you know, a kid of the 80s who grew up with Spielberg and Donner and Zemeckis. And then you have Derek, who has some darker threads running through his screenplay. And then you have what each of these actors brought. And it really is. It's a very complex cocktail. And it's hard to imagine it any other way at a certain point. And even though, you know, you go through this process, I feel like the equation is what it is. And if we were to change the equation, if we were to make Jeff's, you know, Jake Johnson's character a bit more likable and a bit less harsh,
mm-hmm.
that might hurt the equation in other ways. You might be less surprised later on.
We're talking to Colin Trevorrow, the director of the new film Safety Not Guaranteed, spending a few more minutes with him here. I have to ask you about the look of the film as a director, obviously something very important to you, the visual approach to it. And certainly at the beginning, we get a lot more handheld kind of camera look, and there's that kind of sense of personal urgency to it. And also there's, through the digital look, there's a sense of grittiness to it that maybe this absurd subject material, I mean, on its basic level is very absurd, could be broadly comic, but somehow making kind of gritty like that, making it almost feel like a 70s film, does ground it a little bit more. Was that what you were going for?
Absolutely was. And, you know, we shot it on a video camera digitally, the Sony F3, but we used film lenses from the late 70s. We used these great Panavision ultra speeds that gave it, when you shoot through that particular glass, it softens that digital edge, mm-hmm. to a certain extent. So you have that feeling of grain, but it almost gives you the feel of a Super 16 kind of a look. And we also made some very clear decisions to have the movie get more graceful, and the camera would get heavier over the course of the film. It does start off very handheld, and then by the time you get to the end, we're on cranes and moving on dollies, and it's all very fluid and graceful and much more cinematic. And we shot widescreen, and we really try to use the whole frame as much as possible, because we didn't have, you know, either the money or the time to get true scope. There aren't massive vistas. You don't even really see the town in one piece that they're in. And because it's an independent film, it is all a bunch of little pieces all around. So within the context of the frame, we would try and use the widescreen frame as much as possible and have characters in the far left and the far right and really make it feel big, even though you're just in a room.
Well, I feel like to end this, I have to ask you about the ending, and I really have no idea how I'm going to go about doing this, because I don't want to spoil it for anyone, and yet I want to keep it in this interview, because I think it's really fascinating when you have an ending to a film about time travel. The entire audience is wondering, the entire movie, where is this going to go? It's all leading up to something, and we're really curious how the screenwriter and the director are going to face this challenge and how they're going to present it on screen. So without giving away how you guys ultimately landed on it, can you just talk about the challenge of ending this film? And was it something you guys were locked in with right at the beginning and you stuck with it and you just stuck to your ground? Or was it something you really wrestled with?
It was something that we wrestled with, and it was something that didn't exist in the form that you saw it in until the very, very last minute. And the original ending, literally the opposite happens. We had that ending and all the way up to after we were accepted into Sundance. They saw it with that ending.
No kidding.
after our acceptance, I made the decision to change the ending drastically, and not only change the ending of the movie, but it really does change the tone of the film, the genre of the film.
You had to reshoot.
No,
you didn't.
We used footage we already had,
wow.
and what we had shot allowed us to make certain changes that made what goes down.
No kidding.
Go down.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating film. I did really enjoy Safety Not Guaranteed. Colin Trevorrow, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
My thanks again to Colin Trevorrow. Safety Not Guaranteed opened in a few cities last weekend and expands to more screens this weekend, including Chicago. And Josh, you heard most of what I really responded to favorably with the movie there in the interview. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I really didn't buy in as much as you did on this film. We talked about how Your Sister's Sister was small, but that benefited the film in a lot of ways. This just was too small to me. It felt like a movie shrug. A lot of times I think of movies as having personalities, and this one I felt like I needed to rouse it to kind of get it to have something other than nonchalance. That was kind of the overriding emotion I felt was attached to this film.
You didn't think it was
really
funny?
It really didn't. No, it didn't. There were some good things about it. I mean, I was kind of in the middle on it. I could have gone either way, but just at the end, adding up the things that actively annoyed me about it were more than the things that I really got excited about.
Huh. Because I can find almost nothing that annoyed me about it, save for the ending of the film. I do have some ambivalence about how the movie ends, and I say ambivalence because I'm not completely sold that it ends badly or that it's not the best ending of the film, but clearly you heard in the interview that that's something the director and the writer struggle with, and there's just something about the way it ends that puts a little bit too much of an upbeat on everything that I don't really believe about the ending of the film. When you really find out some key information about who these characters are, or I should say Mark Duplass's Kenneth character in particular, you learn some information about him at the end of the film that really changes how you look at him, and the end of the film kind of asks you, I think, to just ignore all that and pretend everything goes on in a good way.
See, I actually did like the ending because that was where the movie had a big moment. It went somewhere. It did something. And I felt like the previous minutes preceding that didn't earn that ending. Does it make sense that it was just kind of a laid back isn't what I'm going for? It was just kind of like I wanted to get the movie out of its seat and get going. It was one of these super casual indies that wasn't doing itself any favors by being that casual.
No, I didn't feel that at all. I really enjoyed all the performances, especially Jake Johnson. He was a huge surprise
here. Oh, no. That was
so funny.
Turn-off role.
Oh,
complete turn-off role.
So funny, and such a role that other people could have played in a really cynical way, in a really smarmy, kind of smug way. And he makes him multidimensional. I thought he was phenomenal. And I like where the movie's heart was in terms of the theme of it, that whole idea of putting yourself out there in the world in a non-cynical way. And it made me laugh. It made me laugh.
Jake Johnson plays the reporter for the magazine who has these interns working for him. And right from the start, he's this jerk and he's sexist. And it's so clearly set up to be a character arc that he's going to have. And so you know exactly where that's going. And so I never believed him. I just kind of, his annoying jerkiness is what stuck with me.
No,
I never believed that
arc. I disagree completely because even as he seems to be such an annoying jerk, but they undermine that. There are so many elements that make him out to be someone that you realize there's more going on than meets
but
the
you
eye.
Bought
it's
those,
almost a character he's playing.
You bought those as anything other than elements that are needed to get him to that point of turnaround? I just never bought him. He was just so noxious to me. And also the other intern was this figure that never worked as a full character either. He's this Indian nerd stereotype cliche. And again, you know, they're going to change that at the end. And we see where that is going.
And
that
it works.
Seems so,
if it didn't work, I'd have a problem with it. But it absolutely delivers.
Does not work at all for me. I will say that Duplass and Plaza are very good together. And their scenes, almost all of their scenes together, work for me very well. There's one really good one that almost turned me on the whole movie altogether. And it's mentioned in the interview, actually, where we find out that it's an improv, where they're sitting in the car and talking about what's your favorite song and how songs bring back memories, and memories can sometimes make you feel good, but at the same time hollow. I thought that was a really sweet moment. And it does tie into the theme that, you know, is kind of obvious in the film, but was a nice one, is just this an idea of trying to change your past, go back and have your life turn out differently somehow. And I did like that. But again, it's something that the movie just kind of has. Here's our theme. So we're going to stick with that. And that's enough to have the movie around. And we're going to go through our scenes. And it never really picked up for me, especially when we get to that end, which hits another level and really shows what I think the movie could have been if it had a little oomph behind it.
I thought it was a sweet movie, and as I said, with some great performances. It's a Safety Not Guaranteed, out in Chicago and select cities this weekend. If you see it, tell us what you thought of it. Email feedback@filmspotting.net.
Have you ever purchased plutonium from Libyans? Pulled a steamship through the Peruvian jungle? Then you might be a movie crackpot. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
When I was playing dead, I'd lie down. I wouldn't move. Though everything else was, the swing set kids playing catch with their bags. No one noticed yet that I was gone. Then she came along. Love, I got cheap in an eye. I got cheap in an eye.
Time to say a few thank yous. We do want to express our gratitude to everyone who has been so generous to support the show just this past week, but of course over 400 shows keeping us doing what we're doing. And this segment is always brought to you by the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, his podcast where he interviews screenwriters and other actors, directors, and filmmakers. After Ray Bradbury's death last week, Jeff decided to change up his plans, and he's actually posting a Ray Bradbury Q&A from 2010's Comic-Con, and he's also going to post the Chinatown Q&A from the Turner Classic Movies Festival with screenwriter Robert Towne and producer Robert Evans. So if you were looking for that previously, it's going to be there now in the Q&A feed. He's also got his new digital magazine Backstory. I think we plugged it a few weeks ago. They were still working out a few technical kinks. Those have been worked out, and Backstory is available, issue 01. It's free to anyone in the world with an iPad.
Jeff's got some really cool stuff, actually, in Backstory. There's interviews with screenwriters, artists, directors, actors, even comic book writers and comedians. The first issue publishes 4 unproduced screenplays that are going to be in their entirety. He's also got 1 stage play. Here's what some of this stuff is. Donnie Darko, writer-director Richard Kelly's script for Bessie, which I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's about a cow whose dangerous supernatural powers could signal the end of mankind. Isn't that so, Kelly?
I want to read it.
I want to see it.
Yeah.
He also has a novelist Rex Pickett's play adaptation of his book Sideways. Issue 1 is free for a limited time, so check it out.
Also want to plug the music we're featuring on this week's show. We decided to tie it in directly to the films we're talking about because as I watched the new movies, Your Sister's Sister and Safety Not Guaranteed, I was really taken with some of the songs. I really enjoyed the music that was chosen for those soundtracks. So in the first segment, you heard Ryan Miller, who is from the band Guster. His music is featured in Safety Not Guaranteed. And then the music you just heard coming into this segment, that's Breathe, Al, Breathe, and that's the music that plays over the end of Your Sister's Sister. So if you want more information about those artists, Guster.com or MySpace.com/Breathe, Al, Breathe. Let's get to our donations. And Josh, because we had a week off, and maybe because it was our 400th episode and people were feeling a little extra generous, wanting to celebrate that with us, we got a lot of donations. We want to keep this segment manageable, though, so we're going to feature a bunch of them this week, and then we're going to come back next week and get to the rest of you. So if we ignored you this week, trust us, we will get to you. We will thank you. We definitely would not want to forget you. So let's start with a couple of gold level donors.
Those would be Kevin in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Mike, one's a party, one's a crowd, Weston from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's his Sam Van Halgren nickname. He's an annual Silver Club donor to the show since 2006, and he added on another $26 for the Film Spotting SVU episodes.
Very nice.
Come out bi-weekly, so a $78 donation from Mike. Thank you so much for that. New $5 a month donors are
Shirley from Austintown, Ohio, Camille right here in Chicago, Kathy S. from Austin, Texas, and Michael E. from Seattle.
Michael writes, with two young kids, it means I get to live vicariously through your reviews and show rather than get out to see actual non-Pixar movies myself, so thanks for that.
Uh-oh, Mike's going to want his money back now that we're going to do Brave.
Yeah, he might.
He's already into Brave. He needs something different.
There you go. A new buck a show donor. This is $1 for every week of the year. Nigel Smith in Tufnell Park, London. And I just have to say, before you read his comments here, Josh, I love the fact that there's someone named Nigel listening from Tufnell Park, London. I mean, how beautiful is that?
Sounds very proper.
Spinal Tap, one of my favorite movies. It goes to 11.
Nigel says, I am currently listening to Film Spotting 400. A buck a show is a bargain for such an enjoyable program each week. And he does spell program, P-R-O-G-R-A-M-M-E, to go with his name. I've loved cinema since my first trip to the pictures. Superman 2, Clash of the Titans was the trailer. But since becoming a Film Spotting listener a few years ago, you've reawakened my teenage film geek, and for that, I thank you.
He also says that we should come visit him in Tufnell Park, London, and I haven't been back to London since I spent a semester there in 1995. Nigel, I'm coming at some point. I'll probably bring my whole family with me. I hope you have a couple extra guest rooms. I'm going to take you up on that. New Silver Club donors to the show.
Brett from Toronto. Megan from Manila, Philippines, Paul, who's from Zurich, Switzerland, and Anne, Bergen, Norway, and then Jerry right here in Chicago.
Yeah, I love the international flavor Silver Club donors. Jerry, I think, is actually the Jerry who helped shoot our 400th live show, the photographer.
Oh, yeah, right. Wow,
thanks,
Jerry. He
came out and worked for us, and then he donated some of the money back to us. Thank you very much, Jerry, for supporting the show. Also want to thank Chris in Austin, Texas, who writes, he's donating in honor of Mr. Webster's film classes at Keeling Middle School. Thanks for enabling great discussions around the kitchen table and providing such inspiration. Thank you, Chris and Mr. Webster. Keep up the great work. Finally, Ben Stark in Huntsville, Alabama donates.
I've been listening since episode 124, and I wish I had been able to donate sooner. I do have a quick plug, if you'll humor me. I'm an Alabama-based filmmaker with a group called Wonder Mill Films. I'll humbly point out that fellow Film Spotting listener Phil Ogden has called us future Golden Brick winners.
Wow, that's a bold statement.
That is. He says it's a badge he'll wear proudly. We're currently running a Kickstarter campaign to get our two independent features, A Genesis Found and The Nocturnal Third, onto Netflix, Hulu, and iTunes. Any folks that would like to contribute can Google Wonder Mill Kickstarter or visit thenocturnalthird.com.
I'm a little bit disappointed because The Nocturnal Third was going to be the name of my next band.
No longer.
But now I can't use it. Best of luck, Ben, and thank you so much for your support of the show. I do hope that one day The Nocturnal Third or one of your future films will be up for Golden Brick consideration.
You never know.
That'd be pretty great. Again, we have many more of you to thank. We'll save them for next week's show.
When I was alive, I didn't know why I'd die. I guess I thought everything was dead. Your hair is red and other lights is black.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower at precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, it just might work.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and as we were thinking about our top five this week, movie crackpots inspired by our discussion of Safety Not Guaranteed and our interview with that director, Colin Trevorrow. You've got a character there in Kenneth who seems like a nut. Obviously, clearly a whack job. He thinks he can go back in time. We learn a little bit more about him as the film goes on, and it got us thinking about similar characters who are maybe misunderstood, maybe a little wacky themselves, and 1.21 gigawatts. Doc Brown is the first character that came to mind, I think, for both of us.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Very clearly, this is going to be the Doc Brown memorial list of our top five movie crackpots, and we need to note that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Randall P. McMurphy, if you want to call Jack Nicholson a crackpot, and we'll get into our definition here in a moment. I want you to kind of explain what we're considering a crackpot. That's excluded. Can't count One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because it is in the Film Spotting pantheon. It's exempt from consideration. We love the movie that much. So, Josh, set this up for everyone a little bit. What's a crackpot?
Well, Cuckoo's Nest does bring up an interesting distinction, because we didn't want these to be people who were completely crazy.
Is he completely crazy, well, though, is the distinction.
Yeah, that's why
not. You
could maybe argue him into the list.
That's
but
right.
For sure, we didn't want someone who was or clearly was. Also, we wanted them to have some level of success in their scheme or plan. And that was one thing I thought about, too, is I wanted kind of this plan in place that they had.
Okay.
A crackpot, to me, has a plan, and so that's kind of what I tried to keep in mind.
I didn't really think about it in those concrete terms. It didn't matter to me if they had a specific plan or not, and I think one of the reasons I ended up forgetting that a little bit as I made my list is when you threw it out on Twitter, hey, give me your best movie crackpots, but they have to succeed in what they're doing. You saw a lot of people suggest Jack T. Ripper from Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Well, he's nuts. He's full-blown nuts, but he does succeed in his plan. Succeeding, though, in his case, doesn't mean society eventually kind of comes around to his way of thinking. He just imposes his way of thinking on society. So just because he succeeds a little bit in what he's trying to do, that doesn't make him eligible for this list for me. The way I thought about it, because, yes, we did approach this the same way, is it's almost like saying it's more your top five movie eccentrics. But even eccentrics doesn't quite work, because then you start thinking about characters like, well, Lester Bangs in Almost Famous is eccentric.
Right.
But I don't think anyone would call him a crackpot. There's nothing about him that really tells you he's crazy. Even the dude from The Big Lebowski could be an eccentric. Doesn't quite fit with this list. Has to be someone on the margins a little bit that most of society, quote-unquote normal society, would look at and say, this guy's off his rocker or this gal's off his rocker. So with that, who's your number five?
My number five is someone who literally lived on the margins, and he's actually a real person. Timothy Treadwell, the subject of Werner Herzog's documentary Grizzly Man.
Wait, he succeeds at his mission?
I'll get to that. He does. I think he does.
The only person that doesn't think he's completely crazy might be Werner Herzog. Actually, he thinks he's crazy too, Josh.
Listen to
okay.
He succeeds in the way that he really meant to succeed, as I read the film.
Becoming one with a grizzly bear?
Yeah, being, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. All right, his scheme was to live with wild grizzlies in remote Alaska, and he pulled this off. Okay, here's some success. And remember, I said some level of success he has to have. He pulled it off for 13 summers. He lived with the grizzlies and survived. Yet I wonder if his real plan wasn't the one that he did ultimately achieve, and that's being killed by these bears along with his girlfriend.
Spoiler alert.
How old is this film?
I know.
And it's
and
a documentary.
It's true. And a documentary, so.
When you look at these videos he's making, a lot of the footage in this documentary is some of the nature videos that Treadwell was purporting to make while he was out there. And a lot of it is footage of him talking in a tantalizing way about the possibility of being killed by bears. I mean, he puts out there that he's in the wild for the calm and the contentment it brings him. But he really seems to get most excited when he talks about this prospect happening to him. So it's almost like he has this death wish. So he succeeds in a couple of ways. He makes it for 13 years, which is much better than anyone would have given him. And I really feel like that's what he might have been going for the whole time.
Well, I'm here with one of my favorite bears. It's Mr. Chocolate. Hey, Mr. Chocolate. He is the star of many people across the country, children, people, adults. And we're here in a grizzly sanctuary, but I'm wrapping up my work here in a grizzly sanctuary. Why is that? Because I'm on my way to the grizzly maze, where bears do not have human protection, but are under human threat. Bears like Aunt Melissa, bears like Demon, Hatchet, Downy, and Tabitha. And it's time for me to go to protect them. I wish I could bring Mr. Chocolate with me. You'd be great protection there. He's been with me for over a decade, and he's been my good friend, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chocolate. I'll see you again next year. Nope. I'll see him again at Expedition, this end of this expedition. I'll be back here to join you again, back with Mr. Chocolate. But first, it's off to the exciting and often dangerous Grizzly Maze.
Wow. It's a pick I didn't consider at all, but I think absolutely qualifies. So well done, and it's a great film. I love Grizzly Man. I think I either had it in my top 20 or my top 25 films of the decade. I like it that much. So Grizzly Man, fantastic choice. Timothy Treadwell. My number five is someone, I wonder if you'll give me grief for this, but I really think it applies. It's a guy who isn't crazy in a macro sense, but on a micro level, within one specific sphere that has its own language, its own rituals, and its own rules. He was absolutely a heretic and written off as completely nuts by the establishment. And that's Billy Bean, the real-life character Billy Bean, the Oakland A's general manager from the Bennett Miller movie Moneyball.
I'll give you that.
Last year.
Yeah, I mean, he was considered a crackpot
exactly.
For sure, and so I think that's one
in
qualification,
baseball circles,
too. Yeah.
He was. This is based on the very successful Michael Lewis book, and He was the GM of a team decimated because of free agency, loses all of his best players, has to find a way to win without the budget that a lot of teams like the Yankees and Red Sox have, and he embraces sabermetrics. He embraces statistical analysis instead of relying on 100 years of conventional baseball wisdom, and everybody does write him off and his team. And this is a movie that last year when it came out, maybe I just built up too many expectations for it because I really love the book and I like baseball. I liked the movie, but I didn't get excited about it the way I was excited for Brad Pitt's performance, my favorite Brad Pitt performance to date in that film.
Benjamin Button?
Fail to appreciate him there, as I fail to appreciate Pitt in most of his performances. But it was just about a month ago, Josh, this came on HBO. I had no intentions of sitting down and watching it. And not only could I not stop watching it, I loved it. Little things that bugged me the first time worked perfectly this time. The whole story in terms of its structure fit together more nicely for me. And moments that I know other people had a real emotional response to, a couple of those moments where it got a little bit dusty in the theater for some people, it didn't hit me on that gut level at all. Watching it on TV for some reason at home this time, it did have that effect on me. Completely different viewing experience watching it the second time. As I said, maybe a little bit void or separate from the expectations I went in with. And I think what Bennett Miller does so well in this movie is he takes very esoteric subject matter. In theory, it should only apply to hardcore baseball nuts out there. And he makes it a story about something bigger and more universal, about a character taking risks and doing what he thinks is right, even if he's going to fail, which I think applies to probably a lot of these crackpots.
Sure. And that's interesting because I really appreciated Moneyball more the second time through as well, for whatever reason.
That's it. You can take us there in a blimp. That's where you'll take us. Cross your heart. Cross it. Cross your heart. Good. You promised. No backing out.
So for my number four, I'm going from a real person, Timothy Treadwell, to not even an actor, an animated figure, Carl Fredrickson in Up, who is voiced by Ed Asner, of course. The best schemes, I think, of crackpots are the ones that we as an audience can buy into. And there's one reason why we buy into the fact that this old guy is going to tie balloons to his house and try to float it to South America. And that's the emotional motivation that he has behind it. Up is not my favorite Pixar film, but I think the prologue may be the best thing that Pixar has ever done.
Speaking of dusty in the theater.
Oh, yeah. Which it traces from their childhood as friends, Carl and his eventual wife, through their entire lives together, decisions they made and choices they had to make and things that happened to them past her death. And all of this is done silently, really, just with the repeated image of her tying his necktie. And it's just so emotional and moving. And it gives you all you need to know about why this guy would fulfill the promise they had made together to go to South America. And there's the eviction twist in the plot that kind of gets it going, that gets him to be so drastic about it with the balloons. But really, that's what we're thinking about as we're watching this house float off into the air, is that emotional connection.
I got to admit, another pick I completely overlooked, but a great film and a great character there. My number four is one I went back and forth on a little bit because I could see an argument being made that they fit more into that eccentric category. But the fact is, they're so eccentric, and it's a pair here, the titular pair, and some people may know where I'm going, but they really do stand outside of society, and it's Harold and Maude from the great Hal Ashby film from the 70s. And it actually makes me think a little bit of Safety Not Guaranteed. Obviously, I find Harold and Maude to be a better film, but that mix of comedy and seriousness that Safety has. And of course, you can't talk about Harold and Maude without mentioning that great Cat Stevens soundtrack. But the main character, Bud Cort, plays Harold. He's obsessed with death. He stages his own death in elaborate ways. And his mother, who's a socialite, is horrified by his behavior and tries to get a doctor to fix him, of course. And he enjoys, just for pleasure, going to funerals. And that's where he meets 79-year-old Maude, played by the great, great Ruth Gordon. And she is this quirky character. Maybe as some listeners suggested, actually, when we did our top five manic pixie girls, she's the oldest manic pixie girl ever.
Hey, this little thing handles well. Ever drive a hearse, Harold?
Yeah.
It's a new experience for me. Shall I take you home now?
This is my car.
Yours?
Oh!
Then you shall take me home.
Like that manic pixie girl that we've come to know in cinema, she allows Harold, she shows Harold how to really embrace life. And I love this film, but I was thinking about today, Josh, in particular, how about the ending of this film? For anyone out there who hasn't seen it, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, but the end of this film is just such a perfect ending to this movie. Just really couldn't have ended any other way. And it's very funny, but it also reinforces the larger theme of the film, as I said, about embracing life. And just, it communicates everything we need to know about Harold and his future in a final moment, especially just showing us with the camera. I think it's really touching, and it's a great film. Harold and Ma, my number four.
Crackpot Partners. I hadn't thought about
there
it that
go.
Way, but
why
yeah,
not?
I like that. My number three, I had lots of good suggestions come through on Twitter, but one that I wasn't thinking of at all and had to include came from Joel Stroop. He's at JMStroop21. It's Ryan Gosling's Lars from Lars and the Real Girl. Didn't occur to me. Seems perfect, so I put it at number three. I do admit I'm not sure what Lars' plan is when he orders a sex doll and begins to cart her around his small Wisconsin town as if she were a real woman. I don't really know what he was going for there. But the key to this movie and why it ends up being this heartwarming delight is that the town goes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, they don't really blink much. At least a lot of the people don't. And they support him and say, okay, well, if you want to do this, you know, I guess that's the way it's going to be. And Lars is, you know, this really shy guy. So in a way, they're kind of seeing it as at least he's, you know, coming out and he's talking and they see some value in it. So the result is that this pathologically shy man gets into the community more. And he eventually meets a real life love interest there. So I guess in a way this could be seen as an extreme form of self-therapy. I don't know if that's what he intended, but hey, it worked.
It does work. It's an appropriate choice. It's a great pick. It'd be even better, though, you know how, if that was a good movie.
You don't like it at all?
I don't like it.
What's your problem with Lars and the Real Girl?
You know, a big part of it is Ryan Gosling.
Oh, wow.
This was back before I really embraced the Gosling.
This was an early indication of the range that he had.
Such a mannered, overdone performance.
So he's no Jake Johnson. I mean,
not in that role. He's not. I'd like to see Jake Johnson in the Real Girl.
No, don't put that in my head.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're arguing about our top five movie crackpots inspired by our discussion of Safety Not Guaranteed. These are people who are a little bit crazy, but not full blown crazy. In some way, maybe society does come around to their way of thinking, or they're vindicated in whatever mission they're on. And I had Harold and Maude as my number four crackpot pair. Now I've got a crackpot trio as my number three. Actually, a crackpot quartet. Let's let Winston Zeddemore explain.
I'm Winston Zeddemore, Your Honor. Look, I've only been with the company for a couple of weeks, but I gotta tell you, these things are real. Since I joined these men, I have seen shit that'll turn you white.
We had Doc Brown and Back to the Future in the poll question up against the Ghostbusters. They had to make my list. You could make the case that it's really Dan Aykroyd's character, Stans, and Harold Ramis' character, Egon Spengler, who are the true crackpots, because Peter Venkman, the Bill Murray character, doesn't really believe what they believe. He doesn't really believe in the paranormal. It takes him seeing it for himself and then determining how he can make a buck off of it for him to become a believer. But this is a movie that's really fresh in my mind. Anyone who follows Film Spotting on Twitter may be aware of this, because just a couple Fridays ago, the rest of the family was out, Josh, and Holden was around, my 10-year-old, and I said, you know what? It's time. It's time for Holden to watch Ghostbusters. We're going to sit down. I'm going to see how he reacts to this, because if he doesn't like it,
you're trading him in.
We've got issues. I mean, if my son, he already doesn't want to play catch with me. If he now doesn't watch Ghostbusters, we've got major problems. I'm going to call the people that Harold's mother calls in Harold and Maude. And we sat down, probably the first time I've seen Ghostbusters in its entirety since I was 9 years old. And not only did I think it was great still, but he thought it was great.
Nice.
And my favorite part was watching Holden react and laugh at a line that was only funny because Bill Murray said it,
mm-hmm.
only because of his delivery. And it's the moment where they're at the library, and one of them, I think it's Ray, says, "Symmetrical book stacking, just like the Philadelphia mass turbulence of 1947. And Murray says, "You're right. No human being would stack books like this." Holden thought that was hilarious. Funniest line in the movie, just listening to Bill Murray say that line. Of course, looking back on it now from the early 80s, the special effects, not so great.
I can imagine.
Really poor in Ghostbusters. It doesn't matter. It's hilarious. And they are crackpots. They are guys who are out there saying that they're capturing ghosts. And of course, you have characters like Walter Peck saying that something must be going on here. It must all be a big laser light show. There's no way this could be real. But of course, it is real. I love that film.
So let me ask you this. If you had to choose, who would be the most crackpotty of all the Ghostbusters?
It's definitely Spangler.
Yeah.
It's got to be Egon, right? Who's so good.
Yeah,
Harold
I think
Ramis
so.
Is really, really,
is.
Really funny in that movie. Just some great lines.
I thought I'd actually have more comedies on my list when I first thought about movie crackpots. But it turns out, no, I've got another rather serious one for number two. It's Charles Farmer, played by Billy Bob Thornton in The Astronaut Farmer. This is a movie that probably most people have forgotten about. It's from 2006.
As is the case with me.
Definitely not seen, yeah. It's from the brothers Mark and Michael Polish, who've sort of faded away since they made this. Though I saw on IMDb.com something about a Jack Kerouac movie that they're working on. I think it's supposed to come out later this year. But in The Astronaut Farmer, Thornton's character is a former astronaut in training who was discharged before he had a chance to fly into space. Now he's spent years running a farm with his wife, who's played by Virginia Madsen, and his three kids. And he decides he's going to build a rocket in his barn. He's going to fly it. He's going to get into space. The movie is really a weird little film. It is a family drama. I think it's PG, and it exists in its own lovely little universe. It's part fable and feels sometimes like a reality show. It's just a delightful movie that no one saw and almost everyone has forgotten. It's not really about whether he launches the rocket or not, although the movie does go there. It's kind of similar to how Safety Not Guaranteed isn't really about whether they time travel or not. But in this case, it's about how dreamers kind of see the world as full of more possibility than the rest of us.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic choice. I do need to see that movie.
You might want to watch it with Holden, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think he'd go for it?
I think so.
He's into space, so he might be drawn to it for that reason. My number two movie crackpot, I'm going back to another film like Ghostbusters from my childhood years, a nostalgia pick for me, but the second name that popped into my head when I thought of this list after Doc Brown, it is Gene Wilder from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I was looking at some of the lines, the best quotes from Willy Wonka earlier today. The suspense is terrible. I hope it'll last. And if the good Lord had intended us to walk, he wouldn't have invented roller skates. That's a crackpot. And Wilder is, of course, brilliant as Wonka. He seems completely off his rocker, a little bit dangerous even. You're not sure you can trust him. But by the end of the film, you realize that he has very pure intentions and that this is a film about a character rewarding the best aspects of children rather than the worst, and in some ways probably gives hope to a lot of people out there watching the film, a lot of kids out there who don't have the same material wealth that many of the characters who win that golden ticket have, and they say, well, you know what, my day is going to come. Maybe if I'm a good person like Charlie, everything will work out. It's the stuff of fantasy, unfortunately, but it absolutely is my number one maybe nostalgia film, the movie that I really remember sitting down with my family along with The Wizard of Oz and turning on and just always being wrapped up in.
Great performance, great character. Isn't he more of an eccentric, though? I mean, does anyone, like, doubt his plans or not think he's like, a huge success?
But as you watch it, I mean, I was looking at the lines again today. Everyone else, every other parent in that movie calls him bonkers. They all say he's lost it. He's gone absolutely crazy. And there are scenes in the movie where he seems to be giving you a lot of evidence that he has completely lost his
mind. If you look at it through the eyes of the parents, he's a crackpot.
So there you go.
That works.
That brings us to our number one, the top slot on our list. And to help us out, we managed to enlist the guy who has been much discussed on this episode of Film Spotting, Mark Duplass. He is the actor of two films opening this weekend, Safety Not Guaranteed and Your Sister's Sister. I had a chance just a few days ago to talk to him via phone, and during our conversation, I managed to wrangle out of him his number one movie crackpot that you like.
I mean, Mark Borchardt from American Movie is the best for me. Someone who believes he's going to make a great film. He has no money. He's a terrible father to his three somewhat illegitimate children. He's an alcoholic, and he lives in the Midwest near no film industry at all. Yet somehow you find yourself rooting for him, and that to me is it's kind of the best version of the crackpot. It's one you can actually root for.
This is ridiculous. We started May 94, man. We've got every F-stop known to man in the film. And right now, we got to take action, man. We got to go out to that field, put those scarecrows in on a killer slant. You know, they've been there for years. The farm's burnt down. It's going to be the opening shots for Coven, you know?
What a great choice. American Movie is a film I absolutely adore, and I hope you'll check out my whole conversation with Mark Duplass about Your Sister's Sister, about Safety Not Guaranteed, and making films with his brother Jay, a little bit of Jeff Who Lives at Home talk and Hump Day talk in there as well, of course. You can get that with the same podcast. We're going to post the Lynn Shelton interview. So if you're a Film Spotting subscriber in iTunes, you'll see that pop up in your feed, or you can go to filmspotting.net and click on interviews. And that brings us, Josh, to your number one.
All right, number one. This is, again, one that came to my mind right away and did end up number one. It's Roy Neary, Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Man.
Again, the plan here is very vague. But once Roy has that run-in with the UFO while working on the electrical line, all he knows is that he has to make models of this mountain vision that he keeps having. And his obstacles are many. A lot of people think he is a crackpot. I mean, his family, especially Terry Garris, his wife, and the military prevents him from coming at the climactic scene to where the aliens are going to arrive. I guess they know he's not a crackpot, but he has more opposition there as well. Many Steven Spielberg films are about wonder, but Close Encounters emphasizes the all-consuming nature that wonder can have. The obsession that can kind of be the dark side of wonder, Close Encounters has that, which not all of his films do, even though they have other similar elements. So for Roy, it literally, this wonder literally consumes him in the end when he willingly goes into the mouth of the spacecraft. And another thing, thinking about this film, I mean, I know there have been special editions and so forth, but how awesome is it that we haven't had a Close Encounters sequel, prequel, anything like that?
Yet. We haven't.
I hope it doesn't happen.
Well, we've actually been discussing this a little bit, how on the show we've done a few of these sacred cow discussions, Pulp Fiction, To Kill a Mockingbird, taken classic films that we haven't seen maybe in a long time or at least a while and revisited them. And a suggestion via Twitter was that Close Encounters of the Third Kind might be a good candidate for that. It's coming up here on its 35th year, so we could kind of do a 35th anniversary
in November.
That show just might happen. I have to admit, though, that's a movie that I thought for sure was going to be on my top five list. 2 weeks ago when we came up with this topic, it was in my head. Close Encounters will definitely make my list. Completely forgot it this time when I sat down. Just like a few weeks ago when we did our Haunted Past movies, I knew A History of Violence was going to be in my top five. It had to be in my top five. Sat down to make my list, completely forgot it. So,
don't you have Siri on your new phone? You just say... put this on my list. I don't have one, so I don't know how it works, but that answers problems
Siri
like this.
Siri should know all of my predilections and
all your top five options. Exactly.
I'm going to work on that.
Okay.
All right. Well, my number one movie crackpot, we'll see if you can get it, Josh, from my bit of Massacre Theater acting here. You don't talk to him, man. You listen to him. He's enlarged my mind. He's a poet warrior in the classic sense, man.
Oh, it's right there. You're going to have to tell me, though.
That was a terrible Dennis Hopper. Just a terrible Dennis Hopper. I don't give you any grief for not recognizing
really bad Dennis Hopper.
My Hopper. My number one is a guy who might just be nuts. And the fact is, this movie should be in the Film Spotting pantheon. I could never convince the other person who used to sit across from me that this movie belonged there. For some reason, Maddie never embraced one of the best films of all time, Apocalypse Now, from Francis Ford Coppola. But my number one is Colonel Kurtz, Marlon Brando's character from Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
What did they tell you? They told me that you had gone totally insane. And that you... methods were unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
I don't see any method at all.
The more I think about it, as nuts as he may be, the movie goes to great lengths to show us the more that Willard discovers about him, the more Willard goes into his own heart of darkness, the more he discovers a respect for Colonel Kurtz. And that respect is based on the fact that Kurtz seems to be on to something a little bit. What he's on to in particular is the hypocrisy of war and of the U.S. government. There are some good lines in there where he says, for example, we train young men to drop fire on people, but their commanders won't allow them to write the F word on their airplanes because it's obscene. And Willard, as I said, discovers this respect for him as he's being sent into the jungle to kill him, because he starts to recognize that the war is being run by, as he calls them, four-star clowns. And it was going to be a circus anyway, he says. So why not do the only thing you really can do to get away from the hypocrisy. Just embrace it. Just go full-blown nuts and start your own society in the jungle, basically start over. As I said, a case could very easily be made that Kurtz is just completely mad, but I just think there's too much rational thought going on
right.
with Kurtz to make him someone you can dismiss that easily.
Yeah, I think he fits crackpot perfectly, but he also is crazy. So, you know, you can be both. You can be a crackpot and be crazy.
And
I
he
think.
Has succeeded on some
yeah,
level.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the film, we can talk about how much success there is in that final moment, but he's set up this new society and it's working for him.
Mm-hmm.
It may not work
yep.
for anybody else.
I didn't think of that at all, but I like
he's
it.
He's happy. So Colonel Kurtz is my number one movie crackpot. What about any honorable mentions?
Honorable mentions, I wrestled with a lot of mad scientists. So I had
yeah.
Colin Clive in 1931's Frankenstein, or Gene Wilder, again, in Young Frankenstein. Clive isn't really the focus of the former, and I recently included Wilder when we did Top 5 Comedy Ensembles and referenced Young Frankenstein, so that kind of knocked it out for me. More mad scientists, and here's a duo. That bizarre couple in Splice, Sarah Polley and Adrian Brody. Creepy, creepy film.
Yeah, I suppose they count.
Also The Fly, of course, Seth
yeah.
Brundle. Could have put him in there. And then, speaking of Herzog, I thought about Aguirre, Wrath of God, but no man who sets out to find El Dorado but ends up stranded on a raft with monkeys can be said to succeed in any way.
No, though, if you think about it, the all-time cinematic crackpot is Klaus Kinski.
Well, right. And, it,
I mean,
and it, it's that film, what's so great about that film is it's facing off of two crackpots with director and star.
Yeah, that worked. They did have an interesting relationship, to say the least. For me, I considered another baseball movie, Ray Kinsella, Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams.
Yeah, I saw someone mention that on Twitter, too.
Considered a crackpot. Speaking of Klaus Kinski and Werner Herzog, Fitzcarraldo, a guy who wants to start an opera, build an opera house in the Peruvian jungle. Of course, he does fail in the end, but he manages to pull a boat over a mountain.
That's a measure of success.
That's crazy, and he succeeds nevertheless. I also considered, though I think he's probably full-blown nuts, Stephen Meek from the Kelly Reichardt film Meek's Cutoff.
Oh, yeah.
And another movie that should probably by now be in the Pantheon if it isn't, you could make the case that Leonard Shelby, Guy Pearce from Christopher Nolan's Memento, is also a crackpot. Certainly that's the way everybody else around him views him. So those are some of my picks. I'd also just like to steal your great picks, Grizzly Man and Close Encounters and Up. All great choices. Those are our top five movie crackpots. Send your picks or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. Tell us how crazy we were for those selections.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting. Or at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out wide this weekend, Rock of Ages. It's finally here, Josh.
One of the things I've learned about
Tom
you
Cruise.
Since we started doing the show is you have a soft spot and a continuing soft spot for hair metal. Yet you're not interested in Rock of Ages.
I'm not at all because it looks just god-awful. But it's true that if you watch the trailer, almost every song in the trailer, my band that I started in junior high, or I shouldn't say I started, I just was the bass player. But the band that I've been in since junior high, we still rock out on those tunes every summer. We got a gig coming up in July.
That
we're playing those
also
songs.
Is one of the most
Poison, Def Leppard.
This is one of the most distressing things I've learned about
rock
you
and
as
roll
well.
All night, Josh, party
oh my
every
goodness.
Day. And that's my boy. I don't know if I had to choose between those two films, Rock of Ages and the Adam Sandler, Andy Samberg. I'm probably going Rock of Ages.
Yeah,
I am.
Well, see, I tried to avoid that music as much as I could during that time period, so I don't
you
think
had taste,
I could
is what you're saying.
Yes, distance myself from that in order to watch Rock of Ages. And honestly, it's been a while since I've subjected myself to a Sandler film. I think I've missed the last couple,
mm-hmm.
so I might have built up enough endurance.
Maybe.
And I really liked him earlier. I'm not just knocking on Sandler, but it's been a while since I've enjoyed one of his films.
Out in limited release, it is a Mark Duplass double feature, Your Sister's Sister, the new movie with Emily Blunt and Rosemary DeWitt from director Lynn Shelton. We both like that movie quite a bit. Safety Not Guaranteed, more of a kind of dark romantic comedy, quirky film that Duplass stars in with Aubrey Plaza, I like a whole lot more than Josh. Those are out in Chicago and select cities this weekend. Also, Lola Versus, the new film with Greta Gerwig and Patong, which is a film that we saw at Ebert's Overlook
right.
Film Festival. We saw it at Ebert Fest back in April. The director, Prashant Bhargava, was there, and he's a Chicago native, made this film. We did not love this movie. Neither of us were really, unfortunately, grabbed by it, but it's a interesting film. There's no doubt about it, with a really interesting visual palette. It is a movie that takes place in an old Indian city called Ahmedabad, and every year they have India's largest kite festival. And we get a family reuniting with this kite festival going on, and that film is one we definitely wanted to mention that's playing on a couple screens here in Chicago this weekend. Next week on the show, the new Pixar film Brave will be opening. We'll talk about that. We may talk about Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. I wouldn't lock that one down, though. And we do plan to get back to our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon with the movie Children of Heaven. I believe it's from 1997, and it is available for streaming via Netflix. So if you've been thinking about jumping in to this marathon, you can do that with Children of Heaven. Our top five is up for debate. If you've got a great tie-in with the movie Brave, something that you think would work well,
yeah, send us some ideas.
We're open to ideas. We just might steal it. We will give you credit for it, though, if we do use it.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artists were Ryan Miller of the band Guster and Breathe Owl Breathe. Learn more at Guster.com and MySpace.com/BreatheOwlBreathe. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.